Again, as we begin today's session, I'd like to encourage everyone to again give the right direction to every effort generated in hearing the Dharma, contemplating on the Dharma, exerting effort in meditating upon the meaning, so that that meaning may arise as confidence that is not dependent upon any external conditions, but is pure conviction, pure devotion, pure realization that permeates so strongly within one's own mind stream that the body, speech, and mind, and the thoughts that the mind generate become indivisible with that realization of the meaning, and a natural flexibility of one's three doors, the body, speech, and mind, arises, where all actions that one engages in becomes nothing but the ground of happiness, causes of happiness, causes of genuine freedom from suffering for all sentient beings, for anyone and everything that one encounters, that it becomes a field, a basis of genuine harmony, genuine peace, genuine source of liberation. So giving that kind of a motivation, sincere motivation, strength, reflecting upon how fortunate it is that despite all the external distractions and conditions of being within in a cyclic existence, as Buddhists particularly recollecting in one's own mind, the diverse experiences of the diverse realms of existences, whether one sees it as just the six different realms of existence, or one sees these six references as a beginning point to allow one's own mind to hold, to contain an awareness of the diversities of life forms that are there, where all sentient beings live life, whether in happiness or whether in suffering. Nevertheless, what sets oneself apart from millions and millions of such sentient beings is the opportunity one has in not only having basic sanity as your core quality, but the realization of this core basic sanity within one's own self, and furthermore, even a much more rarer quality that it joins in, and that is the wish to then better as well as strengthen and make more natural and indivisible within one's own mind stream this basic awareness, this basic sanity. In order that this be nurtured, this sanity, basic awareness, become fruitful and fulfills the purpose of happiness that we all seek, may its encountering of the Dharma be brought into a full use, may it not be distorted by habitual tendencies. And so supplicating to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, particularly knowing they are embodied within one's own Guru, supplicating to the Guru for protection, for guidance, and then knowing that where the blessings of the Guru, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas are there, where it intertwines and unifies with one's own bodhicitta motivation, then it is truly bringing fruition to this precious human life. So thinking in this way, there we begin our session. Today we have been speaking about generating or trying to understand the important quality of compassion that needs to be generated. This is the essence of the Buddhist teachings in general. In particular, the Mahayana teachings are founded upon the essence of arousing genuine goodness, genuine heart of kindness. And in order to be able to emulate the bodhisattvas and to realize one's own intrinsic compassionate mind, how important it is to then engage in the path of training the mind. And so all of us are aware that whatever we do, whatever practices we do, whether it is very beginning stages of entering and exploring what Buddha Dharma means, whether it is a person who has engaged in some more not necessarily simple practices, but still simple, not because the practice is simple or basic, but because our interpretation and our understanding of that practice may be limited. Therefore, simple practices, whatever it may be, to all the various other learned as well as accomplished meditators and practices, many of you who are, know and realize that the purpose for this is other than nothing, other than generating kindness. Now, human psychology and the impact of words, language, to the brain has to be also considered. It is very essential to understand that. Things that we say oftentimes, for example, any of the discursive things, how does anger become so strong? None of us seem to like it, but it is still very strong. How does selfishness become so much a natural thing that we don't even have to think and plan how to be selfish or how to be greedy? It's just something so naturally comes up. Now, how do they gain strength? From the Buddhist perspective, we say these are all creations, projections of your own mind. You give it the power and the strength. And one would question, I don't necessarily give it power. I don't necessarily give it strength. So what is it that makes it very powerful? And the simple answer is familiarization, that you just become so familiar with it. The repetition of a certain action or a certain thought makes things very natural and very so spontaneous that it doesn't need any kind of effort to really sort of project it or to really even paint it in a certain color or a certain form. So in the same way, Buddhists also, on the other hand, not only with the negative, but with the positive qualities, kindness or certain words that we use all the time, emptiness is one, but probably emptiness is for the more mature meditators. Now, for most of us, whether a beginner or someone at the level of having accomplished and learned many practices, we do hear the word kindness, compassion, very oftentimes. Another trick of the ego then is in sort of feeding the information that knowing the word is sufficient. Somewhat that the information that we have, that the information that the brain or the mind gets, begins to assume that that itself is tremendous accomplishment. So whenever we say, generate kindness, we all go, yes. There's immediate agreement. The ego doesn't even put up a fight. So it says, yes, agree with it. The quicker you agree with it, my job's done. Because it somehow fills the mind with the supposition that the intellectual theory understood and to a certain degree boxed in the department of good thoughts. So you catalog it there. And therefore, it immediately sort of we begin to feel that that some work has been done on that. So that impedes the in-depth understanding, the very deepened understanding of not only knowing the word, but realizing the meaning. Therefore, we do come to one of those very often told anecdotes in the life of Naropa when he met with this old woman. And Naropa, the great learned scholar, had studied so much that there was almost no one equal to in his learnings. And so when he once walked out from the university, he met this old woman who asked him, and she was doing her prayers and seemed very much a devout practitioner herself. And so she asked Naropa, do you actually know all the texts? Did you read all these texts that are there in this wonderful collection of library of the university? And Naropa said, yes, yes, I studied them, I've read them. And so she begins to be so happy, she dances around, she says, this is the most remarkable meeting of her life. She's never met someone who has read the words of the Buddha, and it's wonderful to meet such a person. And so Naropa is said to have thought, telling her I've read these texts, she's so happy. How happy she would be if I told her I even understand the meaning of what I have read. And so it is said he told her, yes, I've read it and I've understood the meaning too. And then she broke down in tears and started, you know, her hands and feet all in one direction and beating her heart and chest and sort of weeping and crying. And that really shocked Naropa. And He said, what's the problem here? I tell her I read the words. She's very happy. Now I tell her I even know the meaning of what I read. And now she's in such distress. And so he asked her, what's the problem here? Why are you so much in tears? And why are you so sad when I've told you I realized the meaning? And then it is then that she said, there's nobody who understands the full meaning of the Buddha's word other than the great master Tilopa. And so that's the first encountering of the name of his teacher. And the arousing, the story goes into Naropa's arousing of this great aspiration just by hearing the name Tilopa, that he needed to go, and how much ignorant he still sustained in assuming what he knew were the words of the Buddha, but that there was no genuine actualization of the realization of the meaning, the words that he was reading to. So that encounter is considered to be one of the remarkable examples of how learnedness. Now, in our case, how many of us can claim to be as learned as Naropa? But at the same time, in his own life, the contrast that he observed in words, knowing the meaning, and then deepened understanding of the meaning, experiencing the meaning, and then embodying the meaning. So sense of gradual progress into realizing to such a degree where words no longer are needed to express the meaning. So the actualization is where there is no dependency upon a label and a reference or a concept that sort of satisfies the curiosity of nothing else but the ignorant mind. And so here what I'd like to insert is one of my, what do you call them, pet peeves? About Western practitioners. So one of them is when people refuse to practice, especially your Gondro, the Vajrayana practitioners, because you don't know the material. How many of you say something like that? I'd like to do this practice, but I don't know what I'm doing. Okay. So many people put that. And of course, I can understand that. One can understand how important it is to at least know, if nothing else, the technicalities of what you're doing, to sort of gain an understanding of the purpose of why you are doing it. But why I'm calling it some kind of a sort of a, I don't think pet peeve is really the appropriate, but I'll still say it. Maybe what irritates me when I hear that a little bit is a better word. So is, whom are you trying to? My question to many of the Buddhist students is, whom are you trying to actually pacify at that moment? If your wish to understanding what you are doing is to truly go beyond doubt and hesitation, to fully engage, then that's a very valid question, and that is how it should be. Learning, acquiring wisdom and knowledge is absolutely important. But if it is another voice of the ego, which often it is, most oftentimes it is, because there's resistance to practice, discipline of a rigorous practice has to be founded upon a very decisive determination. If the determination is weak, ego is going to manipulate that weakness because it knows you. Who knows you better than the ego? So therefore, in that manipulation, it's always going to let you locate and look at what is missing rather than what is already there. So from a teacher's perspective, we always say that you know that your life is precious. How firm is your conviction of that? Shouldn't it be sufficient, a sort of inspiration, for you to be back on your cushion? How strong is your understanding? How accurate are you able to understand impermanence? If impermanence is understood by a mind, there is no room for any more distraction or disturbances or impediments that makes any sense at all in the sort of face of the truth of impermanence. Therefore, there is no Vajrayana practice that begins without the basis of preciousness of human existence and contemplation, impermanence, karma, cause and effect, and the suffering of sentient beings. So in terms of an impetus that actually inspires you to finding why you are doing the practice is already there. In some ways, you have enough information. Because life is precious, you meditate. Because it is fragile, you meditate. Because if not in meditation, it's creating havoc to your life and to the others. Because there's no mindfulness strong enough to discern between what to abandon and what to cultivate. Therefore, you meditate. Suffering of sentient beings are unceasing. That has to be ceased. A cessation to the causes have to be brought about. Therefore, you have to meditate. What kind of meditation? For example, probably the most difficult thing would be how does my visualizing a four-headed deity has any relevance to generating good heart, for example? So that's often the sort of doubt that we all begin to have, or sort of an obstruction to our practices that we begin to have. So the question to yourself is, as I said in the beginning, yes, understanding what is the symbolic meaning and all the different kinds of qualities of the icons must be understood, because they are all methods. Nevertheless, a simple answer is, how else would you still your mind? You've tried breathing. You've tried lights. You've tried bindus up, down, everywhere. Isn't it? You've tried engaging in practices, actually doing the general sort of six paramita practices. You've tried them all. If the question still lingers, why am I doing this? It's also indication you failed somewhat. Those methods also. So here is another method. A very simple approach. But that by knowing that the complex ways of visualizing or reciting the mantras, they have, for example, just the creation and completion, all of you know, is a very elaborate Vajrayana system of really working with mind and appearance. But at the same time, when the ignorant mind refuses to be fully confident in the understanding that all appearances are indeed the projection of your own mind, you have no other choice but to hold this visualization. And I always joke and say, for example, the Kaju practitioners, just as an example, have this tremendous fondness for Tara and Cherezi practice. Now, not for any other reason, but because when in the 60s and then the 70s, many of the Kaju centers began in the West, these were the first texts that were translated in their texts. Now, when you started Dharma, you did not know there was a white-bodied, four-armed being who held a lotus and a mala and a jewel at heart. And you did not know there was a green woman. Isn't it? But now, as you continue with these practices and visualizations, now if I sometimes go to them and I suggest, perhaps you should practice Manjushri, or perhaps you should practice Vajrasattva, I find tremendous resistance. They just cannot fit orange-colored, sword-wielding Manjushri, because Cherezi somewhat feels threatened. Or the green lady doesn't move away from your mind. This tremendous loyalty to this form. We call it devotion. Of course, then they say, what do I do with Tara? What do I do with Cherezi? Can I still please do them? So those questions point out to what I'm trying to say over here is, what you did not know existed before, today you struggle. Even when you know this is merely a visualization of your mind. Concepts are like that. You've had a very short history and relationship with these deities, with the other projections of emotions and thoughts, such as grasping, craving, feelings, supposition that it is there and real is a relationship that we've had with these for lifetimes, as Buddhists we say, innumerable lifetimes. And so the Buddha himself says, if you take every earth particle from the earth's surface and you make tiny pea-sized pellets out of it, you would still run out of earth and not be able to count the number of lifetimes that you have taken, whether that is how it is or not. But the consistently relating and owning these impulses have produced a situation where we have tremendous familiarity with our grasping tendencies. These are the concepts, what we call dualistic concepts. Therefore, to defeat it by some amount of knowledge of emptiness, information of emptiness, is not going to be powerful enough. And so therefore, being able to take from the sort of example of Naropa as we were going through, is that words and learning the words are important. But more important is the deepening of the understanding of the meaning of what we are doing. And that has to be sustained in the mind through the discipline of regular mindfulness, regularly keeping in mind a strong determination to realizing and embodying it completely. And so here also in the context of the inspirations, so when we look out for inspiration, all of the different factors, knowledge is important. Steadily you increase knowledge. You know more and more of the Dharma. It answers your questions. But for a meditator to be able to generate strong, decisive determination to engage in the meaning completely, to not be satisfied and complacent about just the information or the knowledge of the words, it is very important to look at what you already know, what you already have. And therefore, such as the Four Noble Truths, suffering, cause, cessation, and path. We've heard it. How much do we reflect upon deepening that which becomes the basis of inspiration for what you do? Much of the answer can be why you do the things you do is found in that, if we allow ourselves to explore it more completely, not be satisfied by just the enumerations of it, but to really regard it with contemplation, with analysis, with examination, that then generates the confidence of what it is that is that these teachings are trying to convey. Likewise, the four immeasurables, yesterday we talked about them, or the four reminders as we talked about them, or the simple fact, mind and appearance. Throughout Hinayana and Mahayana teachings, this is the main focus of all the teachings, is to work with every display in the form of different visual forms that you can see, that we articulate as form concepts. Sound, all the verbal and the non-verbal sound, and particularly the core quality of the mental continuum that is also nowhere else other than projected from within one's own self. Therefore, what is not mind? All projections are mind, all appearances are mind. How far have we been able to explore the truth of this teaching? And in order to be able to not only see it as a theory that has plenty of room for us to not really understand in it, one must then actualize it through the practices. And therefore we do all the practices, whether it is shamatha meditation and vipassana meditation. Both of them are also completely oriented towards the same purpose and the direction of knowing the relationship between mind and appearance. Creation and completion, all the visualizations and the practices of, you know, from the very basic preliminary practices of prostrations to the visualization of lineage tree, guru yoga and mandala practices, creation of deities, dissolution of deities, these are also for the same purpose of really engaging in nothing, but through that method, a deepened understanding of mind and appearance, of how mind holds the entire, whether you say aggregates, whether you say mandala, basically two terms used to really mean the same thing. So when we talk about bindus and tiglis, we are talking about sphere. A sphere is a mandala. Mandala is your mind. Your mind is empty in nature. It is brilliantly generating tremendous intricate forms and shapes and colors and thoughts. The core quality of learning, either by deepened insight or by much more an outward, trying to understand the outward expression, many different methods in Mahayana as well as in Vajrayana are there. And therefore, with that purpose being understood, there is enough sort of meaning that can be useful and inspiring enough for oneself to not let sort of different obstacles impede the path of what it is that you are trying to project, what it is that you're trying to practice. When that doesn't happen, then ego gains victory. It usually wins the argument that you have to wait. And so this is what we do. We are all quite dedicated, diligent in our practices. But at the same time, there's tremendous sense of what we call or assume to be an honest approach. But that honest approach, as honest as it might start off with, but still becomes hijacked by the ego into looking at what you are not able to do, the deficiencies, the different things that are missing, the kind of knowledge and understanding that is missing. Therefore, you're not really able to overcome the doubt and hesitation into engaging wholeheartedly into the path of practices. And so therefore, in that, keeping that obstacle in mind within the tradition of training the mind, the fourth point of training the mind works with what are called five powers, or what are often called also the five abilities or five strengths. And so there are two slogans basically related to taking the core essence, gathered essence of all the teachings of Hinayana and Mahayana into five essential points or five essential what are called powers, five strengths, to practice during lifetime and to practice at the moment of death. So the slogans within the fourth training of the mind are concentrated on how to condense all the Dharma, all the teachings into these five crucial points. And the first point is determination. This is what we have been talking about, where the determination itself tries to find its base upon a very shaky ground that seems to always think, I would like to, but I don't know. Then it's a clear. There's no way to. If a person says, I still don't know why I'm lazy, I don't know why there are so many distractions, the answer is not because you haven't been given the full commentary of a text. That's not the point here, isn't it? The main thing is you forget how precious this life is. You yourself, in order to be able to treasure something, need to recognize the value of what you already have. It's a wonderful, gifted, highly qualified, with tremendous good qualities, this precious human existence. Clearly, such a person who gives into this indecisive or very shaky determination to try and better one's own awareness and mindfulness is a person who forgets impermanence. So, you know, I often talk about the parallelities of the Buddha's life and your own life. In the curriculum of Nalanda and Netartha, Pula Rinpoche is given this extraordinary concentration on the life of the Buddha, isn't it? Why is that so? It's because you can understand the parallelities. Sometimes we think, oh, the parallelities of Buddha's life and my life can't be. We Tibetans, I don't know about the Westerners, but you're following us very quickly in this cultivating bad habits. And one of them is a sense of false humility, mistimed humility. We're never humble all our lives, but there comes one moment where you should not be so humble, and then the ego lets you really become humble at that point. It's the mistimed humility. where we begin to think, how can we even conceive the idea of our life being parallel to the Buddha's life? He was an enlightened one, and we cannot assume to be like him. But that somehow doesn't let us actually see many things that are concurrent, that actually are going the same way as the Buddha's. And so jokingly, I always say, up to about, I think, the 8th or the 9th miraculous activities of the 12 great activities of the Buddha's life that sums up his life, there are lots of similarities. It's the enlightenment, I think the 9th or the 10th, that's where some separation begins to happen between the Buddha's life and our life. In some of the aspects of the 5th and the 6th activities of the Buddha's life, where he encounters birth, old age, sickness, and death, we have better chances than the Buddha. He saw once. Isn't it? We see it all our time, all our life. How many of us have actually encountered those situations where a dear, dear person, family member, parent or a child or a spouse have died, and we really at that point come to a moment where we begin to see the useless, the absolute uselessness of the thousands of things that we hold important in our life. My good friend Laura here recently survived a car crash. So someone like you, because I've been in one, often come to a point where we begin to have that brief, it lasts about 10 or 15 seconds, I think, isn't it? But it is a very, very poignant moment where you can actually see your whole life in those 10, 15 seconds. And you can sort of pick up one thing, if you're lucky, that made sense in this life. And that one thing actually is shared love. People you have loved or people you have received love from. That's very poignant at that moment. Rest of the things don't matter. And so, however, when we forget this kind of a moment, that love, the most important thing, we forget. And all the rest of the things, right down to being the first one in the line to get the latte. When you're queuing up, isn't it? So someone, honks at you from behind, rushes past by, and, you know, I often observe the coming out of the window unnecessarily to shout at that person. Especially sometimes, once I was with a Buddhist practitioner in the car, and he was doing his mantras while driving. And then somebody did something. I didn't even know what had happened, but he rolls down his car with his mala in his hand and yells at this person, rolls up the window, starts continuing with his mala. So these are the things that become very important to us, to respond with aggression, to respond with sense of arrogance, to respond by critically telling the other person's faults and mistakes. That's how the mind keeps wandering, keeps playing tricks with oneself. So, you know, just as I was saying, birth, old age, sickness, and death, especially sickness and death, very apparent to us. But the ego and the ignorance tries to completely make us ignorant of that fact, not look at that. And therefore, the determination begins to weaken, where we have great fondness for practice, but the fondness never is able to become decisive enough to generate strengthened decision to really treasure the precious human existence, to be able to notice moment by moment the fleeting, impermanent nature of life. And therefore, in that midst of having found something so precious, and yet its fragileness being understood, how much strengthened awareness does the mind, how much strengthened awareness are we able to generate that is strongly going to found a strong determination to not waver? And the determination is what kind of a determination? Determination to not let your own mindfulness of your own mind to waver and to be sort of seduced or distracted by the habitual patterns. That there is a constant lingering awareness that you are capable of generating goodness. It needs to be slightly more strengthened and made more ever-present. That can go a step beyond set limitations that you give to yourself, to engage, if it must, in actions that are causes of happiness and goodness towards yourself and the others, so that the next time you are moving your body, it is mindful. So that the next time you're saying something, whether it is verbal or whether it is in the form of thoughts, that you are more aware that this is not going to be a ground of confusion and pain to yourself and to the others. That's just the gentle mindfulness that one needs to generate, which then has to be sustained with the second power, the second point here, and that is familiarization. A determination, strong determination generated without it being combined immediately by familiarization is then going to bring us back to where we are. It is not that we didn't have the determination. We always do have some sense of wishing to do good, developing mindfulness and kindness. But since it is weak in familiarization, one must always make the determination, the motivation, familiar to oneself. So familiar that, if not stronger, at least as strong enough as the familiarities with discursiveness. So, best would be is where you are projecting some kind of irritation, that the familiarity with the sense of knowing this is again your own mind being selfish. It's not about the aggression, it's about your mind selfishly wanting your way. Simultaneously, if it can come up, then that is the mark of familiarization. It would be good if that awareness superseded the projection of the irritation. That's a trained mind. But in the case where it still cannot transform completely a discursiveness to a positive attitude, familiarization is still being strengthened if you're somewhat aware. If you're aware is what we would say, but to sort of begin to work with it, I would say even if it is vaguely aware of what you are doing, you're beginning to work with the attitude of familiarization. And therefore, in the Buddhist tradition, we often talk about the good quality of shame and embarrassment, which is, I think, misunderstood when we translate. Mochada teyu are the two Tibetan words that we use. And then when it is literally translated, it is usually said to be shame and embarrassment, which I find among my Western friends that it means something quite negative, whereas it is an adorning quality in the Buddhist tradition. Just as a crowning glory, what will you say? Something that is the most beautiful ornament in a human, in a sort of adornment or jewelry. Likewise, shame and embarrassment in the Buddhist tradition, or at least what the word, not the word, I think there's a misunderstanding in the word, but mocha and teyu. Mocha, literally, since a lot of the Tibetan words are very evoking of a picture, therefore, mocha would be is when you feel the tinge on your skin. So any action that you're doing that makes you actually feel it, emotionally, you feel that that is wrong. That recognition is then the embarrassment, the shame. So to be shy, to be shamed, to be embarrassed, to feel guilty, that's not what we're talking about. But we're talking about a kind of a very strong awareness that goes before you do something that is embarrassing, where you do know because your senses tell you so, your skin tells you so. What your mind feels, the colors rises in your face. There is a knowing capacity that needs to be heightened, that needs to be more strengthened. Therefore, feeling ashamed is not what we're, that's the resultant state. What we're looking at is the awareness that does come with it, if which it can be strengthened. It could be one of the biggest supports in pulling you back from doing something that is, in most often cases, a cause of pain to you or to the others. Otherwise, why would you be ashamed of it anyway? When one is completely without that attitude of embarrassment, then outrageous wildness in the behavior comes in. And that is where you say and do the things that's just astoundingly vulgar, crude, rude, insulting, aggressive to the others. That indicates only an attitude which doesn't bother about the well-being or what it does to the others at all, so long as you're able to express it. And therefore, in the sense of generating familiarization, strengthening familiarization, it is this alertness of your mind that must watch yourself. Constantly seeing yourself, knowing yourself, that allows the strengthening of pulling back from things that are what your awareness tells you could be a cause of, you know, pain, could be a cause of embarrassment, could be a cause of something that is unhealthy and unnecessary for you and the others. So determination must be combined together with familiarization. And the familiarization will have to face challenges. Being too lenient with yourself, then that's, I think, very difficult and very destructive one, to one's own self. Why, you know, if you look at the progression of the teachings, we find Vajrayana teachings as the very view or the path of practice where guru-student relationship is very emphasized. Even in the Lojong training, especially within the seventh training, there are certain slogans that highly emphasize relating to a guru, for example, to train one's own mind. That is mainly because Hinayana is very independent of a guru. The Shravakayana and the Pratyekayana view, or what are called solitary realizers' view, is very independent. Why it is independent is not because they do not respect the guru principle, but they have a very high sense of awareness, developed awareness of independently training one's own self. And so where you do have that potential, the training of the Hinayana is an excellent path of practice. It requires tremendous courage. Now, however, we've tried that for most of us, isn't it? Self-discipline is a wonderful idea. But wherever the dullness and the distraction of the mind is there, there comes a point in your life where you have to, if you are honest, really say, I need help. I can't do this all by myself. So the Mahayana is kinder. It asks you to see the teacher in everything, in every situation, in every circumstance. Here, what we are talking about, all these 59 slogans of Atisha's, training the mind through the Lojong teachings, 59 different situations, which could be 59 different teachers. Then again, talk about the same mind. It thanks all the 59 different situations and then locks up the door, puts on the iPhone, isn't it? And starts engaging in a conversation that makes you rapidly forget all your 59 different teachers. And so where the mind plays tricks, where it doesn't sort of find self-discipline within its own self, Vajrayana's absolute compassionate, gentle, and caring method, which people often say, Vajrayana is the very sort of stern method, it's a very wrathful method, it's a very esoteric method, and so on and so forth. It's not. Vajrayana is for the weak, for the feeble, for the ones who need the maximum help, who trying to keep their head sort of from drowning within, you know, all the levels of self-deception. And so the kind and the compassionate bodhisattvas manifest in the form of the gurus allow us to then be able to really have a sense of reference, support, and guidance. Where the mind is incapable of training its own self, we surrender ourselves to that reference that allows the same wakefulness to arise. However, the very important factor in that being and absolute trust between the teacher and the student, which is very necessary. In such ways, whether dependent upon the other, whether one's own self-discipline, here we are talking about familiarization that has to be supported. But the familiarization's main support to be able to, whether it is discipline, whether it is the teacher, mainly from the Mahayana's perspective, is then said to be the third strength, the third power. Familiarization must always be made more clean or pure through the seed of virtue. So that's the third. Seed of virtue is being able to take on the commitment of creating virtuous attitude of body, speech, and mind. So from that perspective, it is simply being said, don't talk about compassion or emptiness prior to engaging or being able to bravely engage in the activity of not killing, not indulging in sexual misconduct, and not stealing, not taking what is not given to you. Three actions, negative actions of the body that must be abandoned. Instead, protect lives. Save lives. As a Buddhist, it would be very, very contradictory, a paradox, if we thought and breathe compassion. But when it comes to actually engaging in an activity of even saving one life form, we begin to weigh all the pros and cons, gains and losses, how difficult it is and so forth. Cetar practice, for example, is a wonderful practice that you all don't do. Some of you may do, I don't know. But you all like your cushion, you all like the incense, you all like the latest Dharma books, you know. You all love bone malas brought from Tibet, which are not actually bone, but someone has told you it is. Isn't it? Those things, paraphernalias, those are nice, entertaining. They're good. You should have them if it inspires you. But such as the practice of Cetar, each month, if possible, or at least once a year, making a joint effort to releasing animals that are going to be put to death in a sanctuary, in a place where you can save them. Wonderful, our teachers, for example, would make it a point that those months where one can yearly gather the community of buying thousands of fishes or different kinds of animals, primarily because the easiest way to then sort of release them are sea animals, vast in number. For example, a bowl of soup can sometimes have, 20, 30 living beings in them. And therefore, being able to release them. Such practices must be engaged. But whenever we have told meditators to do that, then you are challenged by how difficult it is. I remember having said the same thing in Greece one time. And very kind woman that I know, she went to, immediately after the session, went to buy some lobsters and then release the lobsters. But then 2 days later, she wrote back to me. She couldn't attend the subsequent talks because the lobster wouldn't go into the water. So she was trying to get the lobster. And so she wrote this whole long email about how difficult it is to actually save a life, protect a life. And it is. You know, all sorts of different challenges arises where we begin to see how in actuality giving happiness, giving life, giving comfort is, which is a very different experience from sitting in the cushion and then saying, may all those who are sick be eliminated from their sicknesses, be freed from their sicknesses through my light or breath or whatever it is. And these are good practices, but the reality of actually engaging in the seed of virtue is a very important practice. That is called familiarization. That brings about familiarization. That challenges your determination. And therefore, in the same way, instead of taking what doesn't belong to you, generously giving, generously being aware of what you can do to make the lives of the others good. The flowers that you use for the mandala offering, for example, is always prepared by the Dharma Center, the host center. often occurs to my mind how nice it would be one day if someone volunteered to bring the flowers for mandala offering that day, if someone volunteered to bring and provide water for everybody for that day. You know, in one of the Dhamma centers that I went to, this happens mainly in Asia. The West still has, I think, a lot to learn about this. But there's one center that I went to in Asia where there is a woman. Her whole practice is that she thinks she, instead of her sitting in the shrine and listening to a teaching or and receiving an empowerment, her practice is to make sure everybody gets a bottle of water, those who are attending. So she always comes to any teaching. Her whole practice is of doing that. So she stays outside, she sweeps after everybody has left, and she provides water for everybody who drinks, making it extraordinarily a joyous experience, inspiring experience for everyone. So that can be done. You don't have to provide water for everyone, but, you know, half a pound of rice doesn't cost very much, but it shows a gesture of generosity that can only come up in a mind that is aware of the needs of the others. You know, cleaning the Dhamma center after a teaching, putting the lights off when nobody's in the room, being kind and gracious in the situation outside, and especially behind the back of the teacher, being really able to convey the same kind of silence and awareness. Those are the seeds of virtue that truly work with the mind having to cultivate awareness. Here is the key to liberation. Here is the basis for genuine compassion, engaged bodhicitta. Where this is then not reflected upon and a carelessness happens. One of the things is very clear is when we are giving teachings, for example, so many of you in one room, and there's absolute decent behavior. Now, in some situations, when we finish with the dedication and everybody gets up, and then you start leaving the room, it's very important to observe yourself, whether how you move your body, how you speak, the noise that you make, and the mind that then immediately goes into me, 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 me. What am I doing? What do I do? What do I get? You know, this expression of the ego demonstrated immediately. One must, as a meditator, work with that particular situation. And that is probably far more the crucial stage than the previous 2.5 hours of well-behaved sort of manners in front of a teacher. Because the contradiction or any kind of pretense or any kind of hypocrisy that one may be nourishing becomes very apparent at that time. So that is your mind. This is your mind. The mind before and the mind after a simple 4-line recitation. So here, seed of virtue is engaging in those what are apparently looks like discipline. And so many people say, oh, this is very suffocating. You have to be disciplined all the time. Yes, but the discipline is a method that reflects or makes you see your reflection very clearly, your attitude's reflection very clearly. Where that is not understood, where the power of insight of relating to that is not understood, what exactly are you going to train then? You don't know your mind. You don't know its shortcomings. You don't know its weaknesses. Therefore, what will you train? And so seed of virtue, therefore, is what challenges the familiarization and the determination. Faithfulness in your relationship, absolutely necessary. Not because of any other reason, but because of the commitment to not create a cause of unhappiness, where the predominance of your own, where the dominance of your own desires supersede the care and the understanding of the needs of the others. And so, jokingly, I always say, retreats, especially when you come to do retreats in India, is a dangerous thing for partners. unless you go into retreat together. That doesn't make sense. So you leave one partner behind. How many times I have seen that? And then your mind, sitting in a cold room in India, is 70% doubtful of what your other partner is doing. And that partner over there is then fully preoccupied with what you might be doing there. And so I used to always say, what's the point of then being in retreat where your concentration is always on the, you know, faithfulness of your own partner and the distractions that it can come? And over the years, you know, I understand now why it is so very strong in the mind. It's because many, many relationships do seem to break up within that small period of time, a month or 2 months. One could understand if it was 2-3 years, but a week, 2 weeks. That's how fragile mind is. Now, that same mind, we're not talking so much about here your faithfulness. Of course, physical attraction is very strong. Emotional attraction is very strong. This is called the desire realm. It is called desire realm for some reason. Isn't it? But what we are talking about is such a fragile mind, that which is so attached to, let's say, a partner even, if so fragile in its determination, same mind has to be plucked from samsara and all its negativities into generating an ever-present, pervasive, non-biased altruism. It's going to be very difficult. Therefore, a realistic approach is to really strengthen self-discipline, your own awareness. And in order to do that, the commitment to be faithful is very, very helpful. Likewise, seed of virtue of not lying, but speaking truthfully. Where your truth can be harmful and hurtful, keep quiet. You know, many times people say, in the race to be honest and truthful, you all end up saying some of the most hurtful things to the other person. In Tibetan, we have a saying where we say, why do you tell a person with a crooked nose he has a crooked nose? It's an expression we use where we say, you don't have to, in your pursuit of being honest, blurt out the most sensitive thing. In the slogans also, it is there. And so being able to watch your speech, honest speech, where is needed, silence most often times. Instead of idle chatter, silence, especially for those of you who say you do not have time for practice. One of the clear ways of reducing distraction and increasing time for practice is to reduce idle chatter and gossip. To be able to have sense of knowing that much of everything that we do talk about is at the cost of happiness, image, opinion of another person. Most often times, even if we are talking about Gaddafi, isn't it? Whether we talk about, Gaddafi, it used to be Osama, now he's dead. Now we changed to Gaddafi and Sadat and so forth. But even if so, the concentration, whether the person is at fault or not, it's our relationship to that which is breeding anger, resentment, critical ideas, something unkind. And so eventually it doesn't matter to the person that you are talking about. What you have sustained is repeated familiarity with a negative impulse, exactly what you are trying to overcome at this time. Therefore, here, being able to be free from the four negativities of the speech, harsh speech, lying, gossip, and slander. And instead, then I always come back to saying silence. It's almost nothing that can be verbally done that is not going to fall into these four categories. When I became a nun, I always thought, lying is something I can easily not do. But here was the biggest problem. I cannot almost say anything that is entirely true. And therefore, that's the extent of the come of speech that one has to understand. And so, watchfulness, see the virtue, use your speech wisely. Say something good, say something kind, use it to inspire other people, otherwise keep quiet. Covetousness, your mind to covet, to want, greed, jealousy, competition, even to covet. Yesterday, Jigme and I had a very good conversation about this. And we were talking about the same thing, discipline in practice. And I was trying to ask Jigme, why is it that still modern-day practitioners, East and West both, are not aware of the importance of discipline of morning session, evening session, a formal session of practice? And Jigme gave me a wonderful answer, and she said, that's because we don't find tangible result in that particular practice, which was very insightful for me to understand. Because tangible result often can be an emotional pacification, peace of mind. So that's why I think many of you do say you love to meditate. And those silence meditations become something that you are more comfortable, and then the big Western thing you feel connected to. I've had to learn all these words. Tibetan, we have no concept of feeling connected to practice. We do the practice. Rwala, Marabela. If we say you have to do the practice, yes, we have to do the practice. Yeah. So we don't search, do I feel connected to Padmasambhava? Do I feel connected to Cherasik or something like that? You know, that's is more like the Eastern way of making connections. Mm-hmm. So you give your address card, you know, calling card, and connections are made that way. But here what we do find is that all of these connections and inspirations, somewhat if they are, and in your own examination, if you find that tangible result, the connection or the inspiration, to be pacification of the emotional mind, then you are looking at practice with an agenda. And an agenda that is so stuck with self and the gratification of the self, then that has brought something very pure into your impure mode of interpretation. And then this is the biggest mistake that we make. Instead of the ordinary self rising to the highest degree of purity, independent of any false concepts, you take that what is the most profound pure view to accommodating a very dull mind. Very ordinary, basic, sort of gross mind. And so fitting into that gross mind is temporary relief. There's no genuine transition and genuine fruition of enlightenment that's going to happen, that's going to take place at that from that kind of a perspective. Therefore, here, covetousness, when we talk about, of course, all the mundane covetousness, but even in your own practice, to covet a self-cherishing benefit that emotionally satisfies you, maybe your own tendency to what Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche very beautifully called creating a cocoon, where you hide and take on a much more passive-aggressive attitude to samsara, rather than having a truly sort of a pure attitude that embraces everyone, that is able to truly have a sense of awareness of goodness that should be experienced by everyone, a much more open attitude. So instead of such a covetousness, replace it with the seed of virtue, of all-embracing lightness, loving-kindness, to be able to truly free your own mind from its agendas of self-pleasing, to give that self-cherishing attitude a rest, to be able to truly engage in something that's good for the others, transforming from that the ninth negative attitude of mind, which is the ill intention. I think in most of us, the blessings of the teachings are such that we don't necessarily have strong intention to harm somebody else. But still, the self-cherishing attitude may be such that it may not necessarily think of doing something for the others. That's more predominant in most of practitioners' mindset. So we don't want to necessarily kill someone or harm somebody or wish negativities on somebody else's life. But there is still enough self-happiness that is so important that you are able to love others after all the loving that you have done to yourself. Whatever is left, the leftover. So in terms of concentrating and your mind being aware of needs, yours is the most important. And whatever time you can take out from that preoccupation, then you give to the others. That kind of intention, when bred for a long period of time, cultivates indifference. Indifference to the sufferings of the others. And so at the crucial point where you have to choose between your comfort and the needs of the others, at such a point, if the negative impulse is sustained, your own comfort will always win. And the responding to the others will mainly come in the form of pity for the others, but not necessarily going out of your comfort zone to be available to the others. So these are all, therefore, tendencies that lead to this very sort of an white-collared executive corporate style of future bodhisattvas. We all sit in our boardrooms, I know, with pens and papers, drawing up sheets and spreadsheets. One breath, two breath, this light, that light, four classifications, six classifications, 10 ways to do generosity, all of these things that we are remarkable at. Vaibhashikas say it in this way, Chittamatrans say it in that way, Madhyamikans say it in that way, are you prasangika, are you swatantrika? We go through all of those categories, and then that's it. Chief executive officers, chief executive bodhisattvas, CEBs, we can call them. So when that kind of a hypocrisy and negligence to groundwork is being done, then training of the mind is just a theory. It's just some vague philosophy that we all sort of talk about but do not engage in. Seed of virtue has to also be supported by the fourth quality of regret, remorse, which again should be correctly understood. Because one of the things, now if you combine the fourth and the fifth training of the mind, the fifth training of the mind is, the fifth point of Lojong training is called evaluating. How much do you evaluate your own training of the mind? Not only in evaluating, but also in the sixth point of training the mind, which is the samayas and the commitments of training the mind. Within the evaluation and within the samayas of training the mind, one in both of these two points, the fifth and the sixth, there are slogans, particularly I think in the commitment section, where it talks about taking what is your weakness and being able to really work with that weakness in overcoming that weakness, that is training the mind. With regard to here also regret, regret is not so much a sense of not only having a kind of a guilty feeling about your not being able to do well, but just as the fifth and the sixth slogan says, learning to understand your weakness, but never making your weakness a setback. But allowing a setback to be, again, go back to greater determination, greater learning, to make it inspiring. That is the correct approach to the cultivation of japa, the fourth point in Tibetan, where we talk about regret. Regret is a very clear, strengthened awareness in your own mind that sees what you have been not able to do, not as you bad Buddhist or you bad meditator, not with that kind of a conceptual idea, but as a way of further gaining confidence in the truth of the Buddha when he said ignorance is the cause of suffering. So the regret allows you to have a much more direct experience of what the true reality of negative impulse is. You come face to face with habitual patterns, and then the next time you know habitual patterns, you have a sense of directly understanding, oh yes, I know this habitual pattern. It's really there, it's very strong. The careless attitude of forgetfulness, or how easily it is to get sort of hijacked by that. How forgetfulness, distraction, dullness of the mind, ignorance, careless attitude, indifference to the sufferings of the others, laziness, ignorance, self-cherishing attitude. How easy these are to pop up, to become more strengthened. Regret is being able to understand that, and from that understanding, have the sort of determination to do better the next time. So from a setback, beginning to come back with greater force, with greater alertness, with greater vigilance. Where that regret is missing in one's person, then you have a very laid-back attitude to training the mind. And it's like a person who never cleans one's room, messy room, if you've been to some people. Just mess everywhere. And then we have one monk who always does this. And because he's an attendant to one of the Rinpoches, and an attendant being messy doesn't help at all. But whenever we try to explain, and then the teacher is very laid back too, so the both of them end up keeping their quarters very messy. And I always go, and I always tell them, why don't you clean this up? And they say, well, what's the point? It gets messy afterwards anyway. Even if you clean up, it again becomes messy. So that kind of an attitude, laid-back attitude. Well, this is how it is. You know me. We say that. You know how I am. You know I didn't mean that. You know, when we say things like that, when you say something insulting, then you understand what I mean. I'm not like that inside, but it's just like that. It's my habit. So those are all the sort of small deceptions that can come up that does lead to really becoming negligent about the wakefulness that is needed in training one's own mind. And then the fifth power, most important, is aspiration. Without aspiration, human mind that is so sort of familiar with the selfishness, the attitude of self-cherishing ego, will not be able to awaken itself from stupor. It's just the basic sleepiness, dullness, that will become more and more gross and heavy in one's own mind stream. So therefore, aspiration is the key antidote to arousing oneself from deep slumber of ignorance. Therefore, reading, recitation, repetition of the recitations are an absolute beneficial support for genuinely engaging in reminding of one's own self. The tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, especially in the Mahayana, in the Vajrayana tradition, a lot of reading is emphasized. Recitation and reading, recitation and reading, even in not understanding what you are reading, but repeatedly reciting a lot of supplications. I think it's very unfortunate that in the West, there's a certain amount of sort of tiredness when it comes to reading and recitation, which is why I think there's not much that has been done. Of course, a lot of translations are being done today. But here, what one has to understand is the benefit of recitation, because each of these great compositions, which are in the form of supplications, such as if you see today what you probably are more familiar with, are the King of Aspirations, Aspiration of Samantabhadra, Aspiration of Maitreya, just the Bodhisattva chants, the praises and the supplications of the various lineage masters. You take, for example, the lineage chants of the Mahamudra lineage, what you read in the morning. Just wonderful words that we have some understanding of, but since the mind is so unclear at this moment, we can't articulate them. And the wonderful great teachers and bodhisattvas have expressed it very eloquently, pithi, to the point that it almost sort of goes into a murky area to try and locate your awareness so that it can connect with the aspiration, with the motivation of the bodhicitta, of the bodhisattvas. So that's the power of prayers, power of aspirations. So when you read them, it's almost like taking layers and layers of deceptive distractions off, where you can sort of swim in clear water and see truly what your mind needs to generate at that point. And so whether short, four lines, or whether, if possible, no, it's up to you. We always say, if your mind is very brilliantly clear, short, keep short recitations. If your mind is really deluded, really confused, if you've had a really hard day, very, very much sort of many thoughts that you can't see clearly, can't think clearly, take a long recitation, such as the King of Aspirations. Read it loudly. That's why loud recitation is important, because you're allowing yourself to express the words that the power of which clarifies a lot of the things to fish out, so to speak, the clearest and the purest expressions that you need to generate. That's the blessing. Being able to really understand the support of these recitations, aspiration benefits the mind. And so, of course, general aspiration to do the practice. You know, we all have aspirations. Do you have the aspiration to be kind? Yes, we have the aspiration to be kind. But since articulation is very important, you do not simply have a vague understanding of aggression, isn't it? You do express it very brilliantly. That's the power of aggression. If aggression were just as vague as our aspiration to be kind, then there would be no problems as such. But the expression is what gives it the power. And therefore, the antidote must also be expressed. And so, aspiration, regret, if we go backwards, seed of virtue, familiarization, and determination. These are five things, five qualities, strengths, powers to be cultivated. If done in life, then at the death, maybe it'll also be just as strong. This is what will go with you at the time of death too. You know, it's very important, having said that, not to glorify death. Tibetans have done this terrible thing over years, hundreds of years, to see death as a beautiful thing. We always like to say that. I've never heard of a Buddhist who's had a bad death. And I can't believe that everyone could have had a bad death, a good death, without being sort of lost in social niceties and, what do you call them, politically correct expressions. We can't train mind by resorting to always beating around the bush, so to speak. If we look carefully, death is not pretty or nice. Whole lifetime of so much conducive conditions that we are surrounded with, which we haven't taken advantage of. Now, at the time of death, when there is this extraordinarily fearful experience of groundlessness, where everything that you have held is taken from you, you have no reference, no form, no feeling, no perceptions, no conditioned phenomena or formation, your own mind itself dissolves into an absolute expansive emptiness. That kind of a groundless experience, which is far, I think, a million times worse than being thrown into space and then letting yourself fall. At such a moment, you're going to be awake and aware and compassionate and realize the nature of bodhicitta and mind and dhammakaya and dissolve and light and radiance and sphere. It's very, very optimistic. It doesn't happen when you have the shrine and the incense and the teachers and the texts and the, you know, regulated temperature. So So to have that kind of a, we all hope, we all will have a much more peaceful death, but to be also very realistic, very practical about that is important. Death will come, it's inevitable. But until it comes, you have time. And to use that time more productively, more sanely, not to be lost in all these, what do you call, grandiose, is it called grandiose? Grandiose ideas, these very fantastic ideas of, you know, sitting in lotus position. And I've seen a lot of people in lotus positions, forcefully put in lotus positions. Some, truthfully, very few, one or two. Most of them, by very kind people, forcefully put in lotus positions where you're not even allowed to die naturally because you're a Buddhist. So those kind of unnecessary fabrications to the path of practice, in life we fabricate, in death we fabricate, has no meaning, has no truthfulness at all in it. And so that has to be understood. And so in the slogans, the fourth slogan, it is training in life, embodying trained mind awareness in life that can then in that moment of death truly arise as a support where one may be able to bring fruition of some happiness, some calmness at the moment of death. So nothing helps. At the moment of death, nothing will help. Not all this knowledge that you know will be of that much of a help as much as through this knowledge, the good karmas that you have created, the good amount of kindness that you have generated, love that you have shared with one another, knowing that you can look back at your life. And as our great teachers have said, you know, I remember my teacher, His Holiness, Trichen Rinpoche. One day we were having a conversation about masters and miracles, you know, all the miraculous things that great masters have done. And Rinpoche, at that point, was talking about a lot of different miraculous activities, especially of Guru Rinpoche and so forth. And so a lot of his students, and we were all there, and asked him, why don't teachers do any more anything miraculous? You know, it would help extraordinarily inspire people to break free from the trust and confidence, especially Vajrayana practitioners. And Rinpoche, of course, he said a lot of things, but to keep it short at that moment, he said, one of the most miraculous things that can be done today is not to create unvirtuous actions. So he would always say, looking back in my life, something that I can be proud of is I've not made anyone unhappy intentionally. So that kind of a teaching has to be cultivated, where you look back at your life and know that it has had the worth, that even if it did not do anything extraordinary, such as sitting under a tree and getting illuminated, but that it did actually bring about some comfort, some happiness, some support and sanity in the lives of the others. That's not impossible. That's very possible. That's something that can be unfolded, that can be done at any time in your life. And therefore, these five powers, and to be able to really take the support of that into creating steadiness of awareness, of mindfulness in your life, becomes essential. Very quickly, now the fifth and the sixth training of the mind, the points of the Lojong training that go into the mind. Within the fifth training, it says, taking these five powers, however, one must always be honest in evaluating yourself carefully. Fifth point of training the mind is in self-evaluation. These five points, subsequently what we have sort of touched base on absolute bodhicitta, relative bodhicitta, taking adversities into the path of bodhi, cultivating these five essential factors, but evaluating your own self. And I think there are about four slogans attached to the evaluation, self-evaluation. But if you condense them, it goes with always one thing that is very helpful in one's own meditation, and that is, of the two witnesses, choose the primary one. Primary one is yourself. There's nobody who knows you better than yourself. The first slogan is, all dharmas agree with one point. Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana teachings, all of them agree in the single point that ultimately that what needs to be transformed is the ego cherishing to a selfless attitude, your true potential, your natural potential. But in order to be able to do that, you'll have to train yourself, because nobody knows you better than yourself. So even when we go to teachers and we say, am I on the right track? It's very funny. Most of the teachers, now today we have a lot of Western teachers, and I think that approach probably will be very, very good. And I think that's the excellent thing that's happening. But so far you've had to relate primarily with a lot of Eastern teachers. And Eastern teachers, no matter, I speak for myself mainly, I don't know about the others, it would be total assumption, but fairly correct, I think, in my assessment, is that we do get very lost in sort of cultural influences. So when you ask a direct question to an Eastern teacher, unless you know the teacher absolutely well and are on a comfortable basis, much is lost in social niceties and politeness. I guess this is everywhere the same. But a teacher perhaps shouldn't be sort of doing that, but it does get. So if you ask a question, am I on the right track? The most common answer you'll get is, yes, but do better. There's always something we try to go indirect with. But what the ears hear is not the do better. It hears you're doing well. Because there's selective hearing. And therefore, that, I think, does a lot of damage sometimes. Also, when people have meditative experiences and you go and explain to a teacher about your meditative experiences, a standard answer is it's a very good meditative experience. Don't grasp to it. So we think, oh, yeah, the grasping is not a problem. But yes, he said it was a good one. So we get stuck over there. So one has to be able to really look at one's own self, trust one's own self. Nobody knows you better than your own self. And through your own realization, through your own awareness, remembering that the fifth point evolves from the fourth point. If there is determination, if there is familiarization, if that requires mindfulness and watchfulness, where you are observing mindfully, aware of your own attitude and conduct, then you are also very capable here of being able to assess yourself and see how much of what you are generating is forced, deliberate, and how much of what you are expressing comes out genuine. But of holding the two witnesses, of the two witnesses, holding the one that is your own self watching must never be discouraging. That's very important. You have to always know that your own assessment of your own faults or inabilities or different setbacks that you have experienced makes you immediately encourage yourself to do better the next time. Where the assessment sort of goes into blame and you are very critical about your own self, then the encouragement that should come doesn't happen. And therefore, a lot of that, I think, makes the sort of the impact of or the consequences of heavily depending upon other witnesses. And your dependency upon that becomes very, very strong, because the self-critical attitude that you have towards yourself is very cutting. So therefore, in being able to have a good assessment, a gentle awareness of being able to see the fault as the ego, not the person. It is the negative impulses, there is the fault, and therefore that assessment making it stronger in the wish to defeat, wish to eliminate the negativities, the dominance of the ego and the ignorance or any other negative attitude becomes essential. And so through that self-analysis, watching yourself, especially becoming fabricated as practitioner, deliberate, that your kindness is forced, it is pretentious, that there is arrogance coming, there is self-cherishing attitude that is being sustained within the disguise of a meditator, that there's passive aggression within one's own self. There is again the tendency to becoming very arrogant with your learnings. These are the hidden weaknesses that must be uncovered by one's own awareness of one's own attitude, by simply asking the question, why do you do it? Why would you do that? If you follow up mistakes, errors, and different negativities that you see yourself doing, questioning why you do that, why did you have to make it so tainted by that same impulse, even a kind word tainted by, let's say, some greed? Why did that taintedness have to come about? Questioning that leads you to deeper exploration of all the deceptiveness of the ego-cherishing mind. That is then the best way to bringing about self-discipline in training one's own self. And then through, again, one of the clear evaluations, and which is the fourth slogan, I think, is being able to engage in every activity with the same essence of this watchfulness. The self-evaluation, or the one that observes one's own attitude and conduct, must be carried into all aspects of your work, daily work. And so it's very important for modern-day meditators to not become so stuck with the formal meditation. Formal meditation is very important. I just spoke a lot about discipline of formal meditation, recitation, and so forth. But on the other hand, when you separate your everyday life from practice, then what you are doing is you're keeping view very separate, meditation very, very separate, and your action in daily life very, very separate. Problem is when the meditation has the view and the action doesn't have the view, that you then begin to find a disjointedness between the two sections. Therefore, no, you do not go into meditation without first studying and understanding the view. A lot of time has to be spent in understanding the view that you are carrying into your path of practice. Doing shamatha alone is never going to be beneficial. You have to have a view with which you are meditating on shamatha. Being able to recite mantras or a prostration or any other practice, form or formless, doing it without an understanding of the view is then simply the outer shell. It's like a stuffed animal versus a real animal. Let's say a tiger, a stuffed tiger and a real tiger. Just the magnetic, sort of the magnetizing powerful quality of it is absolutely missing. Where the view is not there, the life is not there. So when the view is something that is more pervasive, like the sky above, likewise the encompassing view permeates the mind, meditation is to recharge your battery, so to speak. Of all the chaos and the midst of all the distraction, meditation is the reference to still keeping it in touch with what the view needs to be strengthened. So it energizes the view, it makes it more clear, it gives it some kind of reinforcement. But the actual practice is where the view then goes into the action, where every day's life and living moments carry the essence of mindfulness and awakeness, kindness. That is then true practice, truly engaging in the practice. When we engage in the actions of everyday life, sleeping, walking, talking, eating, drinking, whatever mundane activities, but if it is done, being done within the essence of the view being held, evident in the attitude and the conduct, you are now less and less reliant upon formal meditation. Wherever there is more tendencies of forgetfulness in action, you have to always be dependent upon prolonged periods of meditation. Where life itself, like a receding shadow, the negativities all recede, become less and less, and the whole life itself holds the view. View and yourself are inseparable. It is there. This is what we see in the Buddha. This is what we see in our great teachers. What do we see? Do we see them more in sitting or reciting, or do we see them more in permeating that wisdom and compassion in everything that they do? That's what we see. And therefore, that is what we embody. That is what we try to emulate. And so here, therefore, it says, taking on all actions and allowing the awareness to be balanced at all times. And in the Lojong training, it says, to such a point where a skillful rider, I think Adesha's analogy here is of a skillful rider who can ride without falling off the saddle while galloping at great speed. That requires tremendous balance. You put me on the horse. First, putting me on the horse is going to be a challenge. Then the horse makes one movement and we're on the ground. Isn't it? Now, what we are talking about is untrained mind. Trained mind has to become such as that of a skillful rider who can gallop, jump over different kinds of, or what do you call them, hurdles, and still maintain the balance in the same way. What I find, for you, example, is all of you driving, I find just marvelous. That you can actually speed on the freeway or the highway without hitting one another, still having a conversation, singing songs on the cell phone. Isn't it? That requires tremendous single-pointed awareness that is still merged with pervasive awareness. You can do it. If you can drive on this kind of a road, that you can be more alert with your mind while still engaging and responding to everyday activities is a very easy thing to do. It's just the way you look at it. You have, you know, maybe we should have a license issued for pervasive and mingling of pervasive and single-pointed awareness. Then you'd feel more confident. But so, training that way, one then looks at one's own self. Evaluation is very important. And evaluation cannot be, as I said, decided by anyone else, but by your own self and seeing how more merged are you with your view, meditation, and action. But that then, furthermore, the last two points, I think the samaya or the commitment, which is the sixth point, and the guidelines, advices to really working with training the mind, have extraordinarily 16 slogans with the sixth, I think, and then the seventh point of the training having 21 slogans. But they should be, I think, recited, kept in mind at all times, because the commitment and the guidelines have some wonderful slogans that really, if practiced and kept in mind, sustain the mindfulness and the strengthening of trained mind, awakened mind. But one of them, within the sixth point of the training of the mind, very quickly, summarization sort of, refers to not boasting, not sort of demonstrating your trained mind to the others. At this point, where you have worked with bodhicitta, where you're working with transforming adversities, cultivating the five points, if you're truly working with your own self, with a clear self-assession, sometimes setback happens, which is another very extreme thing. A setback happens and then you discourage yourself. That's one extreme. The other is where you do see some good changes happening and a certain subtle arrogance and complacency comes about in your own practices. Both of them have to be avoided, especially the demonstration of your practice and meditation, which is a very ugly thing to do. One must always never forget as a meditator that no matter how much one may be ignorant, other person is not. You have to always keep that in mind. Demonstration of who you are as a practitioner, your knowledge, often comes across or is done by a person, indulged in by a person who has no regard for the wisdom of the other people. Arrogance is like that. An arrogant person never gives credit to the wisdom and the knowledge of the other person, which is apparent in the way you talk, you behave, and the thoughts, of course, that you project. Our teachers used to always say, you can always gauge how learned a person is by one who begins with, I don't know. How much is there that we still don't know of the others? Until the mind has gained such a state of realization that it is truly beyond any self's agenda, making therefore it able to understand others fully. We are not able to have that state of clairvoyance that understands others' situation. Therefore, to assume that we know already what is happening is one of the biggest defeats that you can bring into your own path of training, because that stems progress immediately. Which, of course, often can be seen in physical body language of meditators. The arrogance of physical body, the arrogance in the speech, where you lose touch with groundedness. More the learned, higher the realization, the more flexible, easy, simple physically it will be. In Tibetan we say, you know, life is all about imitations. One must always learn to imitate the best. So when you look at all these great masters, what you find in them is an absolute natural ease and flexibility, physical flexibility. There is no fixation for the solidity of the body itself. Speech is just as gentle, just as kind, just as attentive to the needs of the others. And mind is ever present, ever awakened, ever conscious of the needs of the others. Now, in our case, sometimes, so preoccupied by the self, and greater the amount of rigidity and arrogance that comes, then the body becomes more and more rigid, so rigid, that sometimes among Buddhists we see that. There's a, you know, let's say something like, someone drops something in the kitchen, and there are 10 Buddhists standing. Absolutely doing nothing, because it's not their job. That does happen. Where there is so much rigidity of the body that you really do not know how to be flexible with it. Contrivance in speech is another very interesting thing to observe in our own attitude. Is where there is almost a sense of losing touch with ordinary expressions, ordinary speech. Where what you say is sincere, even if it is something that is not said much. And sometimes, as I talked to you about it the first time also, is that speech where it becomes so contrived. And you're trying to get to a point where you're saying, I don't have time for you. But then it comes out with beginning with, during the time of Padmasambhava, when there was such a situation, and according to Nagarjuna's, where the nature of mind is all expressive, and for you, of course, everything is illusory in nature, but because we ordinary beings are still wrapped up in habitual tendencies, and then the one who's listening is trying to figure out where this conversation is going. Is that it? Just the contrivance in speech. All of this is coming from a mind that is more fixated to the idea of the appearance of Dharma rather than the genuine transcendence and the training that the mind should go through. Where the mind, base of the mind itself is not touched, then whether you have hair, you don't have hair, you're sitting in a cave, not sitting in a cave, you know, have titles or not, it's basically the same. There's no difference. Recognizing that is the commitment that you have, the commitment that you owe to sentient beings, the commitment that you have to your having obtained a precious human existence to actually training the mind. Therefore, the sixth is called the commitment, the samayas of training the mind. It is a commitment that you owe to yourself to train the mind. Being able to really have two important supports in the seventh guidelines, advices of great teachers gathered into all the 21 slogans. But one thing that I think is very helpful is to really have what is called an impetus in the morning and an examination in the evening. Begin your day to really protect and guide your own path of training the mind. Begin your day with renewed sort of enthusiasm, renewed training, renewed strengthened determination to do the best you can in training your mind. Then again, if you say, why should I be the chosen one? Go back to preciousness of human existence, impermanence, karma, suffering. Taking refuge immediately generate a sense of today is a day that you will truly try to embody all the wisdom teachings in training one's own self. And then carry on through the day, but always conclude the day with an assessment, with an examination of what exactly did you, how exactly did you live up to that determination, to that generation of motivation. And so, in the beginning, be sort of lenient with yourself to see simply 2 degrees of more awareness or lessened awareness. Where you can become more clear in your investigation of your own self, where you can hold your own mind, then being very particular about actions. Good actions that have been done and accomplished, be joyful. Be able to really generate sincere joyfulness that allows encouragement to continually do better and more strong to come about. Where negativities and the dominance of distraction still are clearly apparent, regret here. And a regret that immediately transforms into determination to be more watchful, to give yourself another opportunity, another chance to be kinder to yourself. To not forget the fact that you are living in an imperfect world. Nobody ever in the teachings say, you get it right the first time, or even the second time, or even the 100th time. But there is such a thing as gradual progression, and that, therefore, has to be able to sustain the commitments of refuge, commitments of bodhisattva vows, the commitment that you have towards other sentient beings. And so these two sort of referring back to your own mind, these support your mind in training it so that it can become truly able to understand the profound path of Mahayana teachings. And so, very short, all 59 slogans, can't choose any one of them as being one more important than the other. But read them, study them, work with them. Eventually, it all comes down to the same. It's an extraordinarily brilliant opportunity that you have. In having obtained a precious human existence, in having met with the Dharma, in having all the conducive factors that are there. Now, yes, in the 7th slogan, one of my favorite, I think, part of the 7th point of training is reflecting upon the very practical guidance that one needs. A good guru, conducive factors to practice the Dharma that you have to give to your own self, favorable circumstances that you have to give to your own self, sense of deepened enthusiasm, joyful enthusiasm, that you must be able to really invigorate yourself with sense of enthusiasm that is happy in having the opportunity to train your own self. These are the essential qualities that support and that guide you on the path of practice. And so great teachers are there. Of course, I think the principle of guru is still lots to talk about. There's a lot of teachings given on the guru principle. There are lots of materials today that can be read about the guru principle. They're all very, very excellent insights into what the guru-student relationship is. There's a lot of guesswork done by the students and the teachers about what guru-student relationship is. But it still is a topic that is not easy to talk about, because it's not probably contained in being able to express. It's much more about being able to live. And for a guru often, I think a lot is lost primarily because for a guru often to speak about a guru becomes very difficult. And so the student tries to have a lot of guesswork being done, which doesn't often, again, I think, become powerful enough to understand it completely. So, however, a guru's presence in one's own life is very, very essential, very, very important. Part is what I talked about earlier, is that wherever you think you can be independent in disciplining your own self, then that's the most excellent thing. But from a very honest approach, wherever one thinks one is a little bit dependent upon an external reference that would allow you to go beyond your own hesitation, that primarily becomes the guru's presence in one's own life. Now, knowing the qualities of the guru is very essential. That's a whole subject that must be investigated. But on the other hand, what I do want to leave you with is it's not always dependent upon whom you are referring to as the guru. It's very much how much that connection allows the awakening of your own strengthened awareness that can overcome doubt and hesitation. That's what is the most crucial point. So the guru's significance in the life is that it is one that is able to bring out the courage that you can withstand and overcome without any hesitation the impulses of lifetimes of karmic patterns. Anyone who has the capacity, the possibility to be able to bring that about is someone whom you cannot be but utterly grateful. And that gratefulness is not because of the person with whom you have connected to, but because of the qualities that this guru has embodied, which encourages your own mind. And in such a situation, the guru is able to do what all great enlightened beings are not able to do. So guru's importance must be understood to training one's own self. That is one. Conducive factors. Be very realistic in your approach to Dharma. We talk a lot about daily engagement, and I have many friends who say, when I say, what's your daily practice? They will always say, resting in the nature. I think I have a very suspicious mind all the time. So I get very suspicious about that. Because if you are able to really just relax in the nature of mind truthfully, then that's very good. Ultimately, we all aspire to do that. But on the other hand, if it is laziness, if it is simply because you do not want to wake up early in practice, you do not want to sit up late in practice, you do not want to exert effort in still hearing and examining the teachings, then it is again harboring the same dullness of one's own attitude. Truthfully speaking, realistically speaking, where we are at this time in our life with all our neuroses, we still need quiet places. We still need plenty of methods. We're still very dependent upon spiritual friends. We're still very much dependent upon the formalities that allow the mind to accept the challenges of many lifetimes' habitual patterns. And therefore, knowing the importance of conducive factors, connecting to sanghas, connecting to teachers, connecting to spiritual guides, connecting to teachings and teachers, these are things that one must give oneself the opportunity to do so. A space for yourself, time for yourself, time for your mind to becoming more accustomed with its own behavioral patterns. These are all very important in order to do so, and do that with enthusiastic joy, with happiness that you are able to do that. If you yourself do not recognize the tremendous good quality and what it is that you're attempting to do, then it will impact everything else. So if you build the whole foundation of training the mind as a task, then it will become very burdensome. But if you understand it as what else would make better sense in your life than to do that, and find your enthusiasm in the quality of training the mind, then this journey will become something that is lighter, something that is more joyful. And that joyfulness is the key factor to enthusiasm in becoming a good person.